So, the Buddha's experience of enlightenment is about someone realizing the nature of reality. It's about someone becoming aware of reality. Not just aware of reality, but actually becoming, as it were, his whole consciousness becomes steeped with the nature of reality. And, of course, that experience, in a sense, wasn't complete until it was communicated. And the whole of the Dharma, in a sense, is an attempt to communicate the experience of awakening, the experience of realization of reality. And the formulation that most of us know, which is probably the pithiest conceptual kind of communication of the nature of reality, is Pratichitsamutpada. Everything arises in dependence on conditions. Everything happens because of conditions. Conditions, a multiplicity of conditions, expanding out in every direction, and all of those conditions also interrelated, interconnected, dependent on each other, as it were. So that this way of talking about, as it were, the content of the enlightenment experience, by talking about it in terms of Pratichitsamutpada, is a bit abstract. It applies to everything, but what we have to find is a way to make this applicable to our lives. And we've got the whole teaching of the five niyamas, which helps us to do that, because we can see it's applicable to the world, the universe, in totality, as it were. But then we come to how it's applicable to us, or how is it applicable to living a spiritual life. And that's explained, or is communicated through the karma niyama, the law of karma. So what is being said is that because we have a reflexive consciousness, because we're aware that we're aware, we have the possibility of directing our awareness, and therefore we have the possibility of directing the change, the, as it were, impermanence that's part of the nature of reality. So the nature of reality, everything arises in dependence on conditions. Everything is therefore constantly in flux, constantly changing as conditions change. And we can use that nature of reality on the level of our volitional conscious actions in order to direct change, direct transformation in our lives. So that's the law of karma, that's what it's about. And it is, in a sense, the most crucial part of the Dharma life. There is, of course, the Dharma Niyama, but we could, at least for the purposes of this talk, we'll just think of the Dharma Niyama as being the fullness of the Karma Niyama. So when we pursue the spiritual life, when we pursue the spiritual path to its fullness, what it manifests as is what we call the Dharma Niyama, which I'm not going to talk about much this evening. So the first thing to say, I guess, about reality is that reality is not a thing. So you can't be aware of reality, because reality is not something you can be aware of. It's not a thing. So reality is a kind of awareness itself. Yeah, it's not a thing that you can be aware of. We can be aware of the realities of life. We can be aware of the reality of things around us. We can be aware of the reality of our own minds and so on. But even that is a kind of a problem of language, as it were, because the nature of the language is that we have to say aware of something. Something is aware of something. Yeah, something is aware of something. But that kind of gives the wrong impression of the nature of reality, because the nature of reality is not that anything is aware of anything. Yeah, there is... Yes, it's as if this kind of language being made up of subject and object and verb and so on creates a kind of a sense of reality which isn't real. It's just a way of expressing something. So, Pratityasamutpada is saying everything arises in dependence upon conditions. Even that is kind of the same kind of problem of language, as it were. But let's say everything arises in dependence on conditions. Out of that, the big implication of that is impermanence. Everything is impermanent. Nothing stays the same. Everything is changing all the time. But because of the problem with language, we can then think, well, actually, this thing arises in dependence upon these conditions, as it were. But what the teaching of then of shunyata or insubstantiality or whatever is saying to us is no, there isn't a thing that's arising in dependence on conditions. There are just conditions. There's just arising and passing away. There are just conditions. There aren't any things. Conditions arise independent upon conditions, as it were. So the importance to us of this individually is that what we're trying to do is to come to an understanding of what we are and what the implications of that is for how we live. So you could say that there's a kind of inner and outer element or aspect to spiritual life. There's an inner path and an outer path. There's the path of wisdom, which you could see as a kind of inner path, and a path of compassion, which is like an outer path. And the implications from each of those. So the inner path, which is, and both are making use of the law of karma. So you're making use of the fact that actions have consequences. You can direct the flow of change. You can direct where your awareness goes and so on. You're making use of that both in the inner path and the outer path. Yeah. So you're making use of it on the inner path through the investigation of your mind, the investigation of mental states, the investigation of your responses to situations, investigation of your responses to other people, becoming aware of your attachments, becoming aware of your attachments to self-identity in all sorts of ways, becoming aware of your attachments to group identity, becoming aware of your attachment to particular outcomes in life. So by investigating all of these things, by taking your time to, whether in meditation or in reflection, to really investigate what is happening in my mind, what is my mind doing, or even what is my mind, which is, what is my mind? Because it's these kind of what seemingly simple but fundamental questions that take us along the path of wisdom, that inner path. And investigating the particular mental states we experience, investigating them and not in a sense, not taking ourselves too seriously, if you see what I mean. That actually, by investigating our states of mind, what we're doing is we're setting up a little question all the time. We're setting up a little question. This, by the way, is what the Buddha did in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Buddha talks about how before he was enlightened, he just investigated his states of mind. He thought of them in terms of skillful and unskillful, and you tried to see, well, what's going on? Is it skillful? Is it not skillful? But what we have to do is probably a bit more sorting out than that. We have to investigate our states of mind to see, are we objective or are we subjective? What's actually happening? Is this state of mind, is this real, as it were? Is this relating to what's actually happening, or is it just an interpretation that we're relying on, as it were? Because a lot of our mental states will simply be interpretations of the world around us, interpretations of other people, interpretations of reality, in a way. So we have to investigate, is it an interpretation or is it objective? What does it mean for something to be objective? This is how we're moving towards trying to get a sense of reality, a sense of the truth. Yeah. So what we're doing in this kind of investigation, investigating our mental states, investigating our mind, investigating our responses to others, investigating attachments and so on. What we're doing really is we're looking at our sense of self. We're looking at our sense of who we are and what we are and so on. And we're gradually kind of almost like undermining it. We're gradually sort of looking at that sense of self, and through that process of investigation and even analysis, we're seeing more and more clearly that it isn't anything fixed. It isn't anything that you can put your finger on and point to it and say, that's it, that's who I am, that's what I am. We find out, actually, no, it's completely changing all of the time. Which, again, is another reason not to take ourselves too seriously, in a sense. Because, actually, what we often, in particular times, moments, or whatever, think of as being, that's me, that's what I'm like, that's who I am, is actually not. It's something that's moving and changing all the time. And this notion of karma is that you can direct that change. So what often happens if we're not directing the change is the changes that's happening just follow habitual patterns or habitual ruts, as it were. It's like the cart going down the track. It just follows the same track and digs a deeper rut. A deeper habit. And that's what happens if we're not directing the change in our lives. So, but if we bring our awareness to it and bring our attention to it and start to direct it, then we start to become more creative. We move out of the habit of being a particular kind of person. We move out of the habit of being a particular set of responses, just a particular set of habits and ideas. Yeah. So, becoming aware of ourselves, in a way, is quite simple. We just need to become aware of how we create a sense of self, or how we create our own identity. And we can kind of see that through things like what our fears, for instance, our anxieties. If we investigate things like that, and we look at them, and we see how do they arise, and what kind of content they have to do. We start to see how we are creating a sense of being a particular kind of person. Or we look at what we're really wanting in life, what our craving is, or what our aversion is, what we don't want in our lives. If we really look at those things, we start to get a sense of how we are creating a sense of being a particular person. Yeah? Or we look at our attachments, as I said earlier. So we're attached to being a particular kind of person. We're also attached to being part of particular groups, for instance. In the Dasadhamma Sutta, the first thing the Buddha suggests to the monks is they reflect again and again that they have gone forth from being part of any particular group. They reflect again and again on that. So if we if we think about it, we probably find that we do relate to being part of a particular group. It might be a national group, it might be a particular gender, or it might be a particular sexual orientation, it might be a particular political view or something like that. There are lots of different kind of group identities we can have, which what a group identity does is it creates a kind of boundary around us, but this boundary includes lots of other people. But the thing about it being a group identity, it also excludes lots of other people. And it's similar to the boundary that we create around our individual self, as it were. We create a boundary around ourself that excludes others when we have a strong sense of self or ego. Yeah? So it's really worth us looking at our attachment to group identity as well. Sometimes it's actually more fruitful in a way, because it's something that we can actually kind of see more clearly sometimes. It's harder to kind of look at yourself. You often need the help of other people to look at yourself. But actually, group identities, we can kind of see them more clearly. And it can be very fruitful to actually investigate them. Is it really, really important to me to be Irish or Scottish or English or Australian or whatever it is I am? How important is that group identity and so on? How important are other group identities? And by looking at those things, you start to get a sense of how we create a sense of fixed self. Yeah. Of course, the other thing for us to investigate is our habits, because generally what our sense of self is, it's usually this kind of habit. It's a habit of being a particular way. It comes out in us thinking of ourselves, often comes out in terms of how we think about ourselves in the future. We think, I can't do that, or I'm not whatever, you know, the I wouldn't like that, or I wouldn't like this, or whatever. So we're kind of projecting who we are now into the future and assuming that it's always going to be like that, yeah? And it will always be like that if that's how we think about it, you see what I mean? It will always be like that because we can actually stay in the habit of being like that. Or we can direct our change our consciousness, our transformation to be different. Yeah. So if we're practicing, if we're meditating, if we're in good communication with others and so on, it's likely that we will change and we won't be the same in the future. But if we want to be the same in the future, we can be. It's very interesting that actually it's possible for us not to change as well as to change. You can even decide not to change, actually. So if you're happy as you are, you can decide to stay that way. Yeah. So in a way, what I'm talking about there is this inner aspect of reality. We're talking about how you might practice with this inner aspect of reality by investigating yourself, investigating your mind and your habits and your attachments and so on. So that's you're pursuing, as it were, a path of wisdom by doing that, which is, as I said, what the Buddha did. You pursue the path of wisdom in that way. The outer path is more like using karma in terms of external action. So, in terms of, say, the bodhisattva practice, the first practice is dana. Dana is the first of the paramitas, the perfections. So you've got dana, you've got generosity, you've got giving at different levels. You've got giving as a kind of discipline in the precepts, something you do in order to bring about a transformation in yourself, something you do in order to expand your mind. And you've got dana then at the level of a perfection, where it's kind of an expression of whatever wisdom you've attained. You at the level of a perfection, you kind of see the interconnection with others. So there's the one side of pratichit samapada, one side of everything being dependent on conditions, is that there's no fixedness, there's nothing fixed. But another side of it is there's nothing separate, because all the conditions are interrelated. There isn't separateness. There isn't separateness between our different consciousnesses, as it were. There isn't separateness in a definite, defined, and final way. There isn't separateness. So because there isn't separateness, then this outer path of generosity, friendship, communication, sangha, is also how we have to apply the law of karma in order to change ourselves in the direction of compassion. So we start with generosity. I was saying we've got generosity as a precept, we've got generosity as a paramita, as a perfection, which is the practice of the bodhisattva. We've also got generosity as one of the sangrahavastus, which is another level. It's generosity which is purely and simply to bring the spiritual community together. It's exercise in order to bring the spiritual community together. So generosity is a really important practice. It's non-attachment taken to its ultimate, in a way, non-attachment. So in the Abhidharma, where they outline the 51 or 52 mental events or whatever, they don't mention generosity at all. What they mention is non-attachment. And non-attachment is what generosity is. So it's not holding, not grasping onto anything. The things around us, but also not, as it were, ourselves. Because what we want to be able to do in terms of non-attachment is really give ourselves wholeheartedly. We give ourselves, we give of our experience, we give of our gifts and talents and abilities and so on. We just give freely. It's like becoming a kind of overflowing abundance that just flows out and pours out into the world. That's the direction we're trying to move in. It may be that we have to start with generosity as a discipline, because it maybe doesn't come so easily to us or whatever. We start by actually deliberately practicing generosity. And sometimes we have to start in the areas that we find a bit uncomfortable. So if we find it uncomfortable to inconvenience ourselves for the sake of others, we might have to start practicing by inconveniencing ourselves, by going out of our way to help others or whatever. If we find giving money uncomfortable, we might have to start by giving money more than we would normally give. If we find it uncomfortable to, I don't know, give in other ways, just being available to other people, listening to other people as a form of giving, then we can practice with those areas, particularly those areas that we find a little bit uncomfortable. Because when you find it a little bit uncomfortable, what you're coming up against, again, is this sense of your own fixed self. Yeah? You're coming up against where your own, as it were, ego identity has its little antennae, its little boundaries and sensitive bits, as it were. So you're coming up against that, and it's good to kind of work with that. Not obviously to your own detriment, but you have to find ways of moving forward or moving out. And of course, friendship is another practice along this, in this kind of outer way. It's about communication, it's about listening, taking in other people, being available to other people. It's also about seeing, as it were, the wisdom of friendship. It's no accident that the Buddha did say that friendship, spiritual friendship, is the whole of the spiritual life. The reason he said that is because it's in accordance with the nature of reality. It's because there isn't a kind of separateness, and spiritual friendship leads us to the experience of that non-separateness, as it were. So that's why it's the whole of the spiritual life. So friendship is, again, another practice that can take us a long, long way. In fact, according to the Buddha, it can take us to enlightenment in a way. And friendship also includes the notion of receptivity. It's receptivity to teachers, receptivity to spiritual friendship in the sense of teachings coming from somebody who's more experienced. And the whole practice of spiritual community, the whole practice of Sangha, which is slightly different from the practice of friendship, because the practice of friendship is very much between individuals, as it were. The practice of spiritual community is a different kind of practice. It's a collective practice of creating the conditions in which friendships can arise. It's a practice of creating the conditions, the collective conditions, the community conditions, where all of the other practices can happen. Which creates the ground, creates the soil out of which all of the other blooms can bloom, as it were, all of the other practices. So what we're doing when we're practicing in this way, in this outer way, as it were, is we're expanding. It's like in the inner way, we're looking inwards and we're investigating or analyzing or looking at what's going on in a very kind of shining a clear light on something. In this outer practice, we're expanding ourselves. We're expanding beyond boundaries, as it were. Any boundaries that we've set up, we're expanding out beyond that. So we're enlarging our being. We're enlarging our consciousness through the practice in the line of metta, in the line of kindness, because this is practice in the line of metta. So we see this in the actual metta bhavana practice. You're starting with yourself and you expand out, and it's actually, there is no limit to metta. That's in the practice itself. You see that there's no limit to metta. Metta just keeps expanding out, and that's the, in a way, that's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to get to being the kind of being, the kind of person who has no limits to metta, the kind of consciousness that is metta. Yeah, it just is metta. There's a nice little quote from Dante in Living with Kindness about this, which I always like to quote. When metta is experienced in this fully expansive mode and is universal in its scope, there is no experience of a self that is separate from anyone or anything else. To speak of oneself at this stage is almost a contradiction in terms. Just as a circle that has expanded to infinity is not really a circle anymore, so the mind that has expanded to embrace all beings has gone beyond definition. Forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means for you alone, you can go on indefinitely and happily expanding the breadth and depth of your interest and positivity. This is the essence of the spiritual life, to bring about a state in which the whole movement and tendency of our being is expansive, spiraling creatively outwards and upwards. I really love that quote. It's a very kind of pithy way of talking about the spiritual life, but it speaks to me. So I talked about the Pratichit Samuppada, everything arising in dependence on conditions, and how that the aspect of that that's described by the law of karma is what we really need to look at in terms of our actual practice. That karma is saying that we have the ability to focus our awareness, and we have the ability to therefore to focus our transformation and our change here, and we can do that by pursuing the twin paths, inner and outer, and the inner one is much more in terms of investigation of the mind and responses and so on, and the outer one is in terms of actions, in terms of generosity, friendship and sangha. But we need both. One is the path of awareness, you could say, the path of wisdom. The other is the path of expansion, the path of compassion, the path of metta. But of course, they are not separate paths, because, well, impermanence and non-separateness or interconnectedness are not separate. Yeah? Reality is not separated into bits. So they're not really separate paths. In the end, wisdom is compassion. Compassion is wisdom. Two different things. There is no wisdom without compassion. There's no compassion without wisdom. In that story of the Buddha's enlightenment, the kind of archetypes of enlightenment, we have the Buddha overcoming Mara. We have the arising of the Earth Goddess as a witness. We have Brahma Sahampati encouraging the Buddha to teach, and Muchalinda. But all of that is one experience, as it were, is one complete experience being broken down and talked about in terms of different archetypes and so on. The experience is one of awakening and compassion, or awakening into compassion, perhaps you could say. So this, the process, as it were, of integration has to happen at every level. And it happens at the beginning and at the end. We're integrating all the time. So when we're bringing awareness, say, for instance, to our mental states, or to our habits, or to our attachments or whatever, that awareness is helping us to integrate. It's helping us to become more conscious. And you could talk about integration in terms of becoming more conscious. You could talk about it in terms of becoming bigger, more expansive in a way, as in the case of friendship and generosity. So we're looking at something where you're approaching it from different angles, but the end result, as it were, is that you become more integrated. And as you become more integrated, the manifestations of awareness and the manifestations of metta in your life also are integrated. They're there together, as it were. They're not separate things. You become an aware kindness, as it were, or a kind awareness. That's what you're becoming. Yeah? In the tradition, of course, especially in the Mahayana Vajrayana tradition, you have images of this kind of integration at the highest level. You have figures like White Tara. White Tara's compassion, but she has the eyes of wisdom in her hands and so on. It's an integrated image of wisdom and compassion. You have the Yabyum figures of a Buddha and consort in sexual union, which are about that integration of wisdom and compassion. The image is meant to convey that wisdom and compassion are not separate. They're the same thing. I think in terms of this way of looking at becoming more aware of reality, in other words, becoming more real, for some people the inner path is more amenable, and for some people the outer path is more amenable. Yeah, so for some people it will be meditation, reflection and so on, which will be the easiest, as it were. For some people it will be outer action, as in generosity, friendship and all the rest of it will be easier. But actually we do need both, and so it's not enough to just go with what you find the easiest. And the other thing I haven't mentioned is, as well as doing this, we do need, in terms of becoming aware of reality, we do need to study the Dharma, because what that does is it gives us the it gives us the context in which our investigations happen and the context in which our actions happen. So both our inner investigations and our outer actions happen within a context of the right view as expressed by the Dharma. But we need to actually study the Dharma and know that and keep studying it more and more deeply. And that, as it were, adds fuel to the fire of our practice, which is what we need. We need a lot of fuel on that fire. I'm not sure if I have much more to say to you tonight on this. Often enlightenment is talked about in terms of wisdom, compassion, and energy. So it's the wisdom, the awakening, and so on, and the compassion, which is the activity of that. So you get that in the life of the Buddha, his awakening, and then his years of teaching. You get it with the first 60 arahants, where the Buddha tells them to, he says, well, now you've realized what you needed to realize, and now go forth and teach the Dharma for the welfare of the many. So you've got the compassion and the wisdom going together. And the energy, of course, is what's released when the limitations of subjectivity are overcome. We overcome those limitations of ego, the limitations of subjectivity. It releases tremendous energy, and that's the energy with which we then go out to give the Dharma to the world. Yeah, and the figures associated with these three aspects are Avalokiteshvara, associated with the compassion aspect, Manjigosha associated with the wisdom aspect, and Vajrapani with the energy. So when we contemplate these three figures together, we're contemplating the fullness of the enlightenment experience. And of course each figure in themselves also comprehends the full experience of enlightenment. So Manjigosha, although it's the Bodhisattva of wisdom, with his sword of wisdom and his perfection of wisdom book and so on, is also a figure of compassion and so on. So this notion of the integration of wisdom and compassion is in every figure. Every one of these figures integrates wisdom and compassion. I think that's all I've got to say for you.